Welcome to Theology and Sci-Fi, the podcast, Season 2, Episode 4. I am your host, Derek V. Trout, and I'm so thankful that you have decided to join me today. It is good to be back. I've been having a lot going on, needed to take an episode break, so it's been about a month since we've had an episode published, but hopefully that will not happen again. We're back, and here we are recording again, and you are listening, so thank you for that. I truly appreciate that as we continue on here, looking at theological themes and ideas within science fiction and how those relate to the Christian faith. So again, our theme around here comes from really a Clifford D. Simak quote from the fictional preface to his book City. We search for truth in such simple tales as these. And that's what brings us back together today. So thank you. Thank you for joining me. Today we're going back to the small screen and we're going to look at a TV show called The Ray Bradbury Theater. The Ray Bradbury Theater first came out in 1985, and I think it originally came out on HBO, but HBO then is not what it is today. There's nothing content-wise in the Ray Bradbury Theater that would be questionable in terms of content, sexuality, language, violence, all those kinds of things. Very mild in all of that compared to what we see today or to what is accepted in mainstream culture. So from that perspective, there's not really much to worry about or to be concerned about there with the Ray Bradbury Theater. But again, it came out in 1985. We have looked at Ray Bradbury before in episode 3, I believe it was. So we're not going to get too much into who Ray Bradbury was and his background. If you want to go do that, you can listen to episode 3 where we discuss, of season 1, episode 3, where we discuss The Martian Chronicles, a book that he wrote. Here in the Ray Bradbury Theater, what happens is Bradbury writes these episodes. Many of these episodes are based off of short stories that he's already written. So the episode that we're going to look at today is season 4, episode 12 of the Ray Bradbury Theater, an episode titled Here There Be Tigers. Here There Be Tigers. So we're going to look at that episode today, and it's a short episode, about 23 minutes long. I watched it on Amazon Prime. You can watch it on that. It does come with ads, so there will be a couple commercial breaks and different things like that in there, but that's how I watch this. And the Ray Bradbury Theater is something that I really enjoy watching. So again, it started in the mid-80s, so if you look back some of the special effects and some of the things that were going on, video quality-wise and those kinds of things, it's dated. You can see that. But the stories are really well done. I like Bradbury. We've looked at his work before, and it is good. So we're going to be looking at episode 12 of the Ray Bradbury Theater, the episode Here There Be Tigers. And this was the episode that we're going to be looking at today was based on a short story that I believe was written in like 1942. So Bradbury had a bunch of short stories that he wrote. And then he had this TV show picked up, the Ray Bradbury Theater. And then so it's some live action adaptions of these short stories. So you can also go back and you can see that there are several chapters from the Martian Chronicles that have been turned into episodes in the Ray Bradbury Theater. So you can go back and you can watch some. I don't know, there's probably 4 or 5, maybe even more chapters from the Martian Chronicles, which we've already discussed. You can go watch the Ray Bradbury Theater and kind of see a live production of those. So that's something you might want to do. As always, I encourage you to go watch the episode. It is not necessary before listening to this, but if you're able to do that, again, you'll be able to tell it was made 35, 37 years ago, whatever it may be now, you'll be able to tell that it was made then, but the story still holds up. So the story is good, but the effects and the quality of the camera and such is dated, but that just is what it is. So we start on a spaceship that is scanning a planet, and one crew member says to, who I believe is the captain, says, another planet to beat at its own game, Forrester. Get in and take out its minerals and get out before it blows up in your face. We've seen this before. This idea in science fiction is kind of a common idea where people go in and they take the natural resources from a planet, or they even take the natural resources from a place, and it causes some tension. It causes some problems with the natives of that planet because they don't like it that we're just going to go there and take all their stuff. But as people, that's kind of what we've done throughout history. We've gone and found, hey, there's something here that I need. So we're going to go take that land so we can go get that. And if we've seen that happen here on Earth, it makes sense that it would then kind of evolve story-wise into being able to go do that and take those natural resources and what we need from another planet. So we see that idea here. We see that idea. But we are to be good stewards of the planet. This is an idea we've talked about on here before as well on this podcast, that we are to be good stewards of the planet, the creation in which we've been given. In Genesis 1:26, we read, "Then God said, 'Let us make mankind in our own image, in our likeness, so that they may rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky and over the livestock and all the wild animals and over the creatures that move along the ground.'" So this is part of how we as people are made in the image of God, that God makes people and makes us people in his image and likeness. And part of that is that we are given a function. And here that function is to rule over the fish in the sea, the birds in the sky, the livestock, all the wild animals. That is the function that God has given to people to do. So this is a functional view of what it means to be made in the image and likeness of God. He has given us something to do. God governs over creation. And then we, as people who God has created, he has also given us the ability to rule over creation. And as such, we need to take better care of the planet and we need to be good stewards. So somebody tells Forrester, another planet to beat at its own game, just get in and take out the minerals and get out before it blows up in your face. But Forrester says, "You know, we have too much respect for other worlds than to treat them the way you do, Chatterton." So Chatterton is a mineralogist who goes and he is just hired to go take minerals, natural resources, etc. from planets. And Forrester and his crew are the astronauts that get them there. So Chatterton has the job to go take the minerals, but he needs to be able to have a spaceship to go do that, to be able to travel from planet to planet to harvest it for its natural resources. And that's where Forrester and his crew comes in. They are the astronauts that are taking Chatterton and his crew around. So it's discussed for a while as they look at this scan of this planet that it looks like it's good for natural resources, but they're not really able to tell unless they are to get on the surface of the planet, and that's when they can really tell. And then the name of this episode is explained. As the crew descends to the surface of the planet, one of the crew members says, "Here there be tigers." And someone says, what do you mean by that? And she explains that old explorers used to write on their charts, "Here there be tigers," if they wanted to identify dangerous places. So this crew member going down to this planet, this is not the first planet they've gone down to. They've gone down to many planets. They've seen some planets that can be harvested for their minerals, and they come and they bring more people in there to be able to harvest those minerals from that planet. So Chatterton's kind of like they're just exploratory. They go, they drill down. If they find something good, they bring in a larger crew to do that. But if they go to a planet and it's hostile, they don't take anything from it because they get too much resistance. So this isn't their first planet. So the crew thinks that they're going into danger. They think they're going into a hostile environment. So that's why they say, "Here, there be tigers." So the crew lands on the planet and they see that the atmosphere is perfect, that it's been Earth synchronized is what the phrase they use, but there are no signs of life on the planet. So it's perfect to support life, but there is no life. Quite honestly, it's a mathematical impossibility that there would be another planet out there by chance that just happens to support life the way that Earth does. The chances of that happening far outnumber the number of planets that are believed to be in the universe. The chances of that happening, another planet like ours, to be able to support life far outnumbers the number of planets that are believed to be in the universe. Even if you take the high number of estimates on how many planets are believed to be in the universe, the chances of a planet supporting life as ours does is still way outnumbers all those planets in the universe. So the likelihood of that existing, another planet like ours existing by chance, is virtually mathematically impossible. It just doesn't make sense for that to happen according to the odds. But they still, so they land, they see that it's fine to go out, but they still bring their guns with them, even though they've detected no signs of life, because all planets bite and scratch, is what they say. And then Chatterton gets out as well. And for Chatterton, it's too green. It's too peaceful. He doesn't like it. He doesn't trust it. He thinks there's something that's going on with this planet that they can't see because he's been to other planets. And there is no other one like this. So the crew gets off and they're looking around the ship and they're talking about what an amazing and beautiful planet this is. But as soon as Chatterton steps off the ship and onto the ground, the world shakes and it roars. And one of the crew members, a guy named Driscoll, he says, it looks like you're upsetting the gods that rule this planet, Chatterton. Looks as if you're upsetting the gods that rule this planet. That's what he tells Chatterton. Now, I think this is said in jest, but it still gives some indication of theology that they have this idea that there's something in control of this planet. There's something over this planet, and he says that you know, looks like you're upsetting the gods. Not said in quite a literal way, but just in a way that's making fun of Chatterton and what he's doing and what has happened when he stepped off the ship onto the grass with the planet. Shakes and roars out at him, but it still is an indication of theology. But Chatterton just simply blames this on the planet having earthquakes. Well, this planet just must get some earthquakes. But it seems to be very, very coincidental that as soon as his foot hits the ground, stepping off the ship, is when the earthquake and the roaring happens. But Chatterton, he just wants to get to drilling and testing, while the others want to go and explore the planet a little more. Let's see a little bit more about this planet and what this has for us. But Chatterton doesn't like it. He still just doesn't trust this planet. He still just doesn't feel right about it. He wants to call the home base to get another ship on standby to come and save them in case something happens. So it's kind of like he wants to call someone up and say, you know, I don't like this feeling. Get ready to come, load the ship. And as soon as we call, you need to be here. But the other members of the Forrester's crew tell him that it's no good. That the home base no longer sends rescue missions to hostile planets. This is news to Chatterton. He hasn't heard this before, that the home base no longer sends rescue missions to hostile planets. Why? He says, and the answer comes because it's been decided that a spaceship is worth more than a few human beings. So here the home base, whoever this is, whatever organization this may be with, we're not given enough indication to tell who it is. Again, it's a standalone 23-minute episode, so we don't have anything where, like, it's a United Federation of Planets or anything like that. It's just the home base. But the home base has decided that if one ship is in trouble, if they're on a hostile planet, and if they've been abandoned there, it's better to just leave them there than to risk another ship, than to risk another crew. They don't really talk about risking the other crew. They just talk about risking the other ship is what they're looking at, that they don't want to risk a ship, that they view a spaceship as being more valuable than human lives. And friends, we are in trouble if we start to value stuff, things, over human life like they have done here. That we should be placing a value, a worth on human beings made in the image and likeness of God. We should be looking at them as being more valuable, more important, of more worth than spaceships or houses or cars or even planets themselves, whatever it may be. Like, we should be looking at people as being the most valuable part of creation, and not saying that something else, like a spaceship or something else physical, something else tangible, something else that is inanimate, we cannot look at that and say, well, this is worth more than human life. We shouldn't do that. Human life has the highest value placed on it. Jesus lays down his life so that humans can be saved. He doesn't do it so that spaceships or planets or all these other things can be saved. Why does Jesus come to earth? Why does he live a perfect life? Why does he die? Why is he resurrected? For people, for you, and for me. That he places the highest value on people, and we should do the same, even though the home base here in this episode does not. Now, to everyone but Chatterton, this seems like a perfect planet. It just seems amazing. They love it. And Driscoll is walking around the planet just talking about how great this planet is, how wonderful it is, and how it just reminds him of being a child and being able to run free and As a child, he loved to run in the wind and wish that he could fly and just wanted to be able to do that. And in all of its full 1980s special effects glory, Driscoll begins to fly. It's quite cheesy. It's graphically terrible in the terms of special effects, but he flies. He runs and spreads his wings, and he is able to fly without the assistance of anything else. But he doesn't know how he does it. He just knows that he has asked to fly, that he has wished to fly, and now he can. But Chatterton, who has just seen Driscoll fly without any assistance, he has just seen him run, spread his arms. He flies as though his arms are wings, and he flies around the sky and comes and lands. Chatterton has just seen that. But what he says is that it's all rubbish. Ah, that was just all rubbish. It was just a freakish air current that Chatterton says he has seen before. That's quite amazing, Chatterton. If he has gone there and, oh, just a magical, just some kind of freak air current that picked you up and let you fly. And I've seen that before. Really? Have you, Chatterton? Because that's pretty amazing. What Chatterton does is decides to not believe even in the face of evidence. He's literally just seen a man fly to spread his arms, to take off from the ground, but yet when he lands, he tries to give a naturalistic explanation for it. He tries to explain the supernatural with the natural, and it falls short. It doesn't make sense that would be that kind of explanation, that there would be some kind of wind gust that would pick somebody up and let them fly circles around you and fly up and down and left and right and have a controlled path. It doesn't make sense that would just be some kind of freakish air current. And I think it's certainly questionable whether Chatterton has actually seen this before or not. So what he is doing is trying to explain the supernatural with the natural, and it falls short because you can't explain the supernatural with the natural. That's part of the meaning of supernatural. It goes beyond the natural. And when he tries to do that, he looks foolish, and it just doesn't work. But Driscoll says it's no air current. It's something else. It's something alive. It's a power. It's a force. And Driscoll is talking about literally the planet. That it's not some air current on the planet, but it's the planet itself that has allowed him to do this. That the planet is alive. That the planet has power. That the planet is a force. This is something that's very pantheistic. So pantheism would say that everything is or is a part of God. So all of creation is part of or is God. So you would look at a planet, and the planet would be part of God. It would be a part of that creation. Everything that's physically created would be a part of God. Pantheism, pan meaning all, theism talking about God. So it's pantheism, this pantheistic understanding that everything would be God. But it might even be a little deeper than pantheism, because it's not just that this planet is a part of God or is somehow sacred or something like that, but the planet itself is actually alive. So it kind of even goes beyond pantheism, where it's talking about the planet having a force, the planet having an energy, the planet having something within it that makes the planet itself actually be alive. So that's what we're looking at here. And this planet has the ability to affect gravity, at the very least, it would seem, to be able to let Driscoll fly. So it has some consciousness. It has some intelligence. It has power. It has the ability to do these things. So when we look at this, sometimes this may even go to the notion of somebody talking about Mother Earth as though Mother Earth, the Earth itself, was a live, breathing being, that's what it could be. But the Earth itself is not alive in the sense of having consciousness and having intelligence and things like that. But this planet here that they've landed on is alive. And it just kind of goes back to that pantheistic idea of everything's alive, or everything is a part of God, or has God within it. But it kind of even takes it a step further with giving a consciousness to this planet. But Driscoll says he thinks that he can do it again. He thinks that he can fly again. And he says, I think we can all do it. And Chatterton really doesn't like that. Chatterton then pulls a gun on him and tells him no. Like, no, you're not going to do this again. So Chatterton really must be struggling with the idea of the supernatural being real. Well, now we're not given that indication necessarily in the show, but why else would he pull a gun on him when he just wants to show him to demonstrate that they can all fly? There seems to be a problem here that Chatterton has with the supernatural. But Chatterton, as he's pointing his gun at Driscoll, he starts to float in the air himself. This planet will not allow Chatterton to hold his gun on Driscoll. But then Driscoll says, put him down, put him down, put him down. And Chatterton lowers to the ground. And we see here that Driscoll's idea that this planet is alive, that this planet has supernatural powers, that it has a consciousness, is the case. As Driscoll talks with the planet, speaks with the planet, and the planet responds. But that's not really how the planets are. That's not really how they work. Planets are not alive. They are not intelligent. They do not have the ability to be able to influence natural laws because the planets are part of creation, not the creator. And the creator is the only one who has that power. So God is the only one who has that power. And we would say that God is created in a way that is ex nihilo. That is Latin for out of nothing. So how did God create the planet that we are on now? God created that out of nothing. God speaks and creation happens. He literally speaks things into creation. His words turn into something physical. His word, he creates out of nothing and actually speaks into creation. The planet has not been here forever. It's been created. There was a time when this planet was not. There was a time when creation was not. And before that time, there was and still is to this day and will be forever. There's God. That is who is eternal without beginning or end. So there's a lot of problems here with Driscoll looking at this planet as being alive, and sometimes that goes over into some kind of different religions or understandings that people have today relating to, again, that idea of Mother Earth or how the universe has energies or powers or whatever that may be, but that's just simply not the case. And when you are opening yourself up to Mother Earth or energies out there or whatever it may be, you can be opening yourself to some very dangerous things because there is a spiritual world and there are forces of good in that spiritual world and there are forces of evil. And if you are opening yourself up to any of the energies out there, it is a very, very dangerous thing that you are doing because who knows what is going to respond to that invitation and what is going to come inside. We don't like to talk about demon possession and things like that, but that happens and still does happen. That's something that people still today experience. So if you're just opening yourself up to the universe and those energies and that being and that feeling, that is a very, very dangerous thing to do. But Driscoll asks the planet to set Chatterton down, and the planet responds. It does. He sets him down, and Chatterton puts his gun away. And then they find water on the planet. There's a flowing river, and they go and they test the water, and it's pure water, but it tastes like wine. So it's pure water they could go and drink, but it has the taste of wine. And this water is great tasting for all of them, except when Chatterton goes to take a drink, he spits it out and says that it tastes like vinegar. So those that are here, that like the planet, that support the planet, that are being good to the planet, the water tastes like wine. But the one who wants to come and take the resources from the planet, and the water for him tastes like vinegar. So there is an environmental there is an environmental case, there is an environmental ethic that is being presented here. Those who are being good to the planet is being good to them. The one who is not being good to the planet's not being good to him. So it does kind of come back to this idea here too of, you know, if we're going to be good to creation, creation's going to be good to us. If we're not going to be good to creation, creation's not going to be good to us. And there may be some truth to that because that means we're being good stewards. And if we're taking care of the earth the way that it should, the earth is going to produce and it's going to do things that it should do. and it's going to function the way that it was meant to function. But if we take bad care of the planet, if we do things that we shouldn't be doing, and we pollute and put toxins and all this other kind of stuff into the environment, it can and does affect Earth and the way that things happen. But that does not mean that Earth is alive, that is looking at people who have good intentions to treat it good and is rewarding them, and that looking at people who are trying to do, who are doing things that are bad for the Earth and then coming out and punishing them because of that. That's not the way that that works. But there are cause and effect consequences. If we take good care of the Earth is going to do what it should do, and it's going to function in a way that it's meant to function. If we take poor care of the Earth, there can be consequences for that, for what can happen in regards to all different kinds of things within our environment and such. So we do need to take care of the Earth, but we don't take care of the Earth so that the Earth can be good to us. That's not the way that that works, even though that's the way that it works here on this planet in this episode. So Forrester says, it's too bad that we don't have some fish to go with this wine. And then part of the river starts to bubble, and Driscoll sticks his hands in, and it's warm water, and he reaches in and pulls out a perfectly cooked fish. So again, the planet has given what they have asked for, it has provided what they have asked for. And Driscoll says the planet is alive, and it's a living thing, and a living thing must have a purpose. But is that true? Must living things have a purpose? Certainly, God creates people with a purpose to be in relationship with Him, to be able to share in creation, to be able to experience this thing that we call life that God has called good and has wanted to share it with other beings that are made in His image and likeness. So here we are because God has wanted to share that with us. So we have a purpose to live in fellowship and union and relationship with God and to know Him and to spread His word. So we do have a purpose, and we can look at things throughout all of creation and see that different things do have its purpose. All the things have its purpose, right? We understand food chains, we understand environments, and we understand habitats and all these different things that go into it. And even though none of us like mosquitoes and don't know, like, why can't we just get rid of those? They actually have a purpose as well. Like they serve something. So there is things in here that, So this idea that living things do have a purpose. Now, must they have a purpose? I don't know about that, but certainly God has created things that do have a purpose, and human beings are included in that. But Driscoll says that if the planet is alive and if it has a purpose, then this planet's purpose must be to make someone. Driscoll says the purpose of this planet must be to make someone, us, happy. That's the purpose of this planet, is to make them happy. So they are looking at the planet, something that is conscious and intelligent and has the ability to do supernatural things, as why does this planet exist? To make me happy. And friends, that is the way that some people look at God. Why does God exist? Well, so that I can be happy. God wants me to be happy. And if I'm in trouble, I can go to God and He can bail me out so that I can be happy and that I can find my inner peace and that I can find all these other different things to make me happy. Friends, God does not exist just so that you'll be happy. God wants to give you something so much more, so much better than just happiness. He wants to give you joy. He wants to give you peace. He wants to give you contentment. He wants to bring a fullness and a wholeness to your soul that is missing something. He accepts you into His family. He loves you unconditionally. He will give you purpose and meaning. That's what God brings to us. Not just this idea of happiness. He brings so much more, where we can have a hope and a joy and an assurance that we know Him and can be with Him forever. So God is not first and foremost just primarily concerned with our happiness. He's concerned with who we are and how we are relating to Him and how we are relating to the people and creation that He has created for us to take care of and for us to interact with. So God's not primarily concerned about our happiness. He's concerned about our relationship, our status with Him, and if we are entering into that relationship where we are at times when we are denying our own happiness to be obedient to what God has called us to do. Not everything God has called us to do, we do happily. Are we happy about? There are some things, though, but are we going to be obedient to that? Are we going to be obedient to what God has called us to do and who God has called us to be? Or are we going to think, well, God, since you've created me, you just owe me some happiness? No, that's not the way that this works. God doesn't owe you to make you happy. God, the reason God created you is not just to be happy. That is such a low bar. God has created you for so much more than just to be happy. To know him and to be known by him and to enter into a relationship with him so that we can have fulfillment and peace and contentment. God has created us for so much more than happiness. But back to the episode, and Driscoll says, what good is a bag full of miracles if you have no one to share them with? So he's starting to want to plant seeds that he's going to want to stay on this planet. And then something interesting happens when Chatterton goes to eat the fish. For him, it tastes terrible. He spits it out and says, this fish is poison, is what he says. But for everybody else, it tastes good. But for Chatterton, he just can't stomach it. And then the crew is talking about this, and is this food good? Is this not good? Whatever. And they look around and they notice that Chatterton is gone. They can't find where he is. He's gone, but he's gone back to the ship, and he gets his drills and starts mining the planet to get his samples that he needs to be able to see if they're going to bring a team here to mine this or not. But as Chatterton is drilling down into the planet is shaking, and the planet is screaming. And is yelling out in pain as the drills go down into the surface of the planet. And then the crew runs back. They see what Chatterton's doing. And Driscoll tells Chatterton, you've got to stop. But Chatterton refuses to. And then all of a sudden, this lightning strikes down on the drill that's going down on the surface. And it just blows this drill up and completely destroys it. And then Chatterton says that this planet may be alive, but it's not going to be alive for long. And then he runs into the forest. It's kind of a weird move. I don't know where he's going. I don't know what he plans on doing, but he runs into the forest. And then in the forest, he's attacked by something. I'm not sure what it is. And we presume that he is killed. He gets attacked. It's kind of turns something sneaking up on him. He turns around, yells. We cut to the crew. They hear Chatterton scream. We see no more from him. So we presume that he's been killed. And then Driscoll talks about how now that Chatterton is gone, that the planet trusts them and they can trust the planet. And this planet will grant them their every wish. The planet will grant them their every wish. Now that Chatterton's gone, they can trust the planet and the planet can trust them. But Driscoll, he then really makes a case that he wants to stay on the planet. But then he makes a good point there that if they tell the people of Earth how marvelous this planet is, if they go back and tell everyone on Earth how great it is, they would all come to this planet that they're on and ruin it. Now, Forrester disagrees because he says he doesn't think the planet would allow for a full, wide-scale invasion. Doesn't think that they would allow for that. But Driscoll wants to stay on this perfect planet that will give them anything that he wishes for. But Forrester, he says they actually really only have one option. They need to go back to the ship, and they need to declare this planet hostile so that it would be outlawed from anyone ever going to again, that they would put an X on their map saying that it was hostile, that no one would ever come here again, so that they wouldn't know what this planet is and what the potential that this planet could have. But he also justified that by saying that if we mark this planet as being hostile, it really would be hostile to the average person like Chatterton. It was a hostile planet to him. So Forrester says, we have a job. We've had people who have hired us. They have paid us. We have a responsibility to those who have employed us. So we need to go and we need to fulfill our contract. And as good as this planet looks, we just need to mark it as hostile and leave it. But Driscoll doesn't want to leave it. Driscoll calls it the Garden of Eden. And Forrester says, yeah, forbidden fruit. I think that's not a exactly a great response or analogy for that. This certainly does in some ways seem to be Eden-esque, but even in the Garden of Eden, it's not like the garden just all of a sudden gave you everything you wanted or had a river that, you know, the water tasted like wine and would, you know, cook your fish for you on demand. That's not what the Garden of Eden did. That's not what that was about. And talking about how this is forbidden fruit because it's the Garden of Eden, I don't think that analogy really works. But Driscoll, he tries to stay on the planet, but the planet quakes again and it's shaking, and all the crew boards the ship except for Driscoll. He flees and he goes away and they can't catch him because of the planet shaking. You know, the ship is there. They're getting readings that it's time to go, but Driscoll remains on the planet. And as the crew flies away in the ship, they see a volcano and they get worried about Driscoll. Like, is this going to get him? Like, there's a volcano here. But Forrester says, that volcano is not for Driscoll. That volcano is for us. It's the planet that's feeling rejected and it's telling us to never come back. That's what the erupting volcano means to Forrester. And then we cut to Driscoll, who has stayed on the planet. He walks through the forest and he finds a woman who is getting a drink from a pond or a river or something like that. She's got some water in her hand, we presume, getting a drink. And all we see, though, is her reflection in the water. So Driscoll comes up to a woman who is getting a drink in the water, even though there were no life forces, no life forms detected on this planet. Apparently, Driscoll has asked, now that he is alone, for some companionship, and the planet has responded. So we see the reflection of this woman. And then we roll credits, and that is the end of the episode. So here, that does it for the episode. Here, There Be Tigers of the Ray Bradbury Theater, where we've discussed pantheism and living planets, and even doubting in the face of evidence, and how humans perhaps cannot be trusted with such a planet. And to be able to look at this planet and to be able to get anything they wished from it is a very dangerous thing from this planet. But it really doesn't give them anything they wish. It just gives them what they wish if the planet's okay with it. Because the planet's not giving Chatterton what he wants, but it's giving the other ones what they want. So it's this planet where if you're good to the creation will be good to you. And if you're not good to creation will not be good to you. But that's not the way that creation acts, because creation is not a living thing. It doesn't have consciousness and being on its own. That is God who is the creator, not the created, because the created does not have that. So we go through and we look at this episode, and there's some really interesting things that take place. And again, I think it's making an environmental ethical claim here of how we should treat the environment. And it really does come back to this idea that if we treat the planet well, the planet will treat us well. And in terms of cause and effect and how we are being good stewards, there may be some truth to that. But that does not mean that our planet Earth is alive and is actively, consciously responding with those things when we treat our planet well. It does not actively and consciously treat us well. That's not what this is about, the way that cause and effect works. So it's a really interesting episode here. I really like the Ray Bradbury Theater. There's five or six seasons worth going through, worth watching. Again, you'll laugh at some of the special effects and you'll see how dated it is and how cheesy it is, but the stories still stand up. So we look at this story here, and really what we see are some claims about how we should be good caretakers of creation, and that is true. We should be good stewards of that. But it also has kind of this underlying idea that of Mother Nature or Mother Earth somehow being alive and being conscious, but that is just not the case, because the Earth is created, not creator. So this has been a fun time getting back, diving into this. I've been wanting to talk about one of these Ray Bradbury Theater episodes for quite a while. I actually thought about talking about another one, but switched to this one after I watched it. So we might even discuss one of these sometime at a later time. But I'd encourage you, if you have Amazon Prime Video, to go and to check it out, to watch these episodes. They're under a half hour, worth watching. They're usually really good story-wise and something that I truly enjoy. I'm a huge Ray Bradbury fan and just think this is another way another way that his work is really able to shine, and that we can see what's going on, and just a fun chance to be able to look at that. So if you have a chance, go check out the Ray Bradbury Theater. Well, thanks for listening. Again, it is good to be back with you. I missed the last episode. A lot of things going on, pretty busy on this end of things, but we're going to try to keep releasing an episode every 2 weeks, at least through the end of the year, and just see how that goes. So if you have enjoyed this episode, or if you have any comments or questions or thoughts, I would love to hear from you. You can contact me at Theology and Sci-Fi, the podcast on Facebook, or you can go to Twitter or Instagram for Theology and Sci-Fi, or you can email me at theologyandsci-fi@gmail.com. Again, we spell sci-fi the correct way around here, S-C-I-F-I. And so if you want to contact me, those are some ways that you can do that. And tell a friend or two and see if we can kind of grow this and get some more people to listen and get some more feedback. Also, just want to remind you to look for theological themes for things to discuss when you're out at the movies or reading a book or whatever it may be, so you can have that opportunity to bring up these conversations with your friends so that you can use this as a vehicle to talk about some really important issues that we have here in life. The most important questions that we have in life as we look at who God is and how we can relate to God and how we can know God and be known by God. So what did you think of this episode? I'd love to hear from you. I'm not sure where we'll go for the next episode yet. We'll go back probably to a short story, something that we'll read. So if you have a short story from science fiction that you would want me to look at, I would love to hear from you. Or if you have a sci-fi TV show that you want me to take a look at one of the episodes, I would love to hear from that as well. So any suggestions are open and are accepted. Just let me know what you would like to take a look at, and we'll try to make that happen. So this has been fun. I truly do enjoy this, and I'm glad to be back. This is a fun little episode to look at, and it has some really interesting claims that we can see here in theology. Again, I think we see more and more often this idea of somehow creation being alive or being able to speak or being able to respond, but that is just not the case because the earth is created, not creator. So there's a time when this was not, when we were not, when this planet was not, and God has created, and he is the one in charge. He is the one that has the power and the ability to do things that go beyond the natural. That is not something that belongs to Mother Earth or Mother Nature, whatever you want to call that. It belongs to God and God alone. Again, thank you for listening. I'd love to hear from you. Any suggestions, any thoughts, any comments, any feedback, please reach out and talk to me. It'd be great to continue on this conversation with you. So thanks for listening. For Theology and Sci-Fi, I am Derek V. Trout. Here, there be tigers.